If you haven't already signed in, would you go ahead and sign in?
I did.
You did? You both signed in?
Yes, sir.
All right. Ms. Reed, you have 15 minutes. Do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
2 minutes it is. And you can start whenever you're ready.
Okay, Judge. Good morning. It may please the court. So we have two issues that are before the court. One is with regard to the protective sweep, and then one is with regard to counsel. They're pretty unrelated. So I'll start with the protective sweep.
Right. Look, okay. I have one question for you as to each of these assignments of error. If you want to start with the protective sweep, we can certainly do that. And for the purposes of my question, I want you to assume that the protective sweep was as unconstitutional as it can get, okay? Can you point to the argument you make on brief is that essentially that improper sweep tainted the execution of the search warrant. Can you point us to any specific evidence that was contained in the search warrant affidavit that was the product of this illegal protective sweep?
Your Honor, what I can the one part that I can point to, and I understand that is the court's concern, is that on page 316 of the appendix on the in the affidavit for the search warrant, it states that when describing the place, person, or thing to be searched is described as followed. It just says the residence is currently secured by law officers. That is the only reference in the.
And that is not a reference to evidence that would support.
No, I'm sorry. No, it was just a reference to the protective sweep. It is not a reference. The court is correct that it is not a reference in terms of. Evidence.
The reason I ask that question is because the court never ruled on the legality of the sweep. And since the court never ruled on it, we can't rule on it. So the only issue left then is the issue the court did rule on, which is that it doesn't make any difference because there was no impact. In other words, the exclusionary rule that simply doesn't apply to this situation. Or at least not, it doesn't extend to the search warrant because there's no indication of anything in the search warrant that was obtained in the sweep. So if that's the case, tell us how the exclusionary rule could possibly apply, again, for the purpose of my question, assuming that this was a bad a violation of the Fourth Amendment to do the sweep in the first place.
Your Honor, the only thing that I can point to in the record is just that the affidavit for the search warrant just referred to the protective sweep. The court is correct that there was no evidence from the questioning of the officers that they saw anything in the residence. It is a stretch of an argument, I will admit.
Well, let me ask my one question with respect to the second assignment of error, if I can. How can this court possibly reach the merits of it? I'm sure you're familiar with Code 19.2-254. This was a conditional guilty plea. And as I read the appendix, the guilty plea form, the only issue that your client reserved the right to appeal, because obviously a guilty plea normally waives your right to appeal anything other than subject matter jurisdiction. But the only reservation that's consistent with 254, 19.2254, is the reservation of the right to appeal the legality of the search of his residence, not any Sixth Amendment issues.
Your Honor, I would say that the guilty plea form and the colloquy is just is error in and of itself, that the court should not have proceeded on
The problem with that analysis is that there was no, the issue before us is not the trial court erred in refusing to vacate the guilty plea. That's not the issue before us. The issue before us has to do with appointment of counsel. That was not reserved in the appeal. I mean, we're a court of limited appellate jurisdiction prescribed by statute. And if it isn't covered by a statute, we don't have jurisdiction to address it. So I guess my thought, similar to the first issue, is assuming you even had any merit to this argument, how could we possibly legally address it when we have no jurisdiction to do so?
I think that that Mr. Brown was in a position to not know to even preserve that argument with regard to the fact that his guilty plea was taken in error because he didn't have counsel. It's a catch-22. I mean, it's a difficult situation because if he had, in fact, had counsel, we probably wouldn't be arguing this point.
But can't convey jurisdiction on ourselves.
I understand. But the Mr. Brown, when he did not have counsel, he didn't know to reserve the right that he... There
might be a habeas argument, I suppose, but
And he had standby counsel.
He did have standby counsel. I think the concern, so in the argument, there are points where Mr. Brown is indicating to the court during the colloquy, and I think, and even with on the second page of the guilty plea where the court strikes out, I understand that the court has found that I have waived my right to counsel. I mean, there is an issue before the court that the court is aware of that Mr. Brown does not have counsel at that time. I think crossing that line out, saying that he is not, in fact, waiving his right to counsel, does that, in fact, preserve the issue that the guilty plea is should not have been accepted because he didn't have counsel? I'm on page 46 of the appendix on paragraph 10.
Well, I'm looking at his the guilty plea form that he signed and that was part of the colloquy, and subsection 4 says, quote, I understand that by pleading guilty, I waive all objections to the admissibility of the evidence, the legality of my arrest, and any search and seizure of property, except as to this court's ruling on December 16, 2014 regarding the legality of the search of my residence. Again, it seems to me pursuant to 19.2-254, which is a conditional guilty plea statute, that's a statutory exception to the basic premise that you waive any right to appeal anything. So it seems to me, pursuant to the statute, all we could consider is what your client specifically reserved, whether he should have done it or should have done it better. I mean, it is what it is.
Right, but he couldn't. I mean, he didn't have counsel in order to advise him to preserve that.
Sounds like a great habeas argument. They're upstairs.
I understand. And again, I would just refer, and just looking at this now in terms of the guilty plea, again, notwithstanding your argument, Your Honor, that in even the guilty plea in that paragraph above that, it says, you know, my attorney has explained what the Commonwealth must prove. Well, he didn't have an attorney at that time when he was entering in this guilty plea. So it may, in fact, be that this issue is a habeas issue. But, in fact, he, throughout the proceedings, and I think the record is inundated with his statements, I am not waiving my right to counsel. I do not want to go for. I mean, he says it over and over, even when they're talking, even when the trial court is engaging in a colloquy about something else in terms of the motion to eliminate. He says, "I'm not prepared to go to trial. I need an attorney." You know, so so notwithstanding that argument, Your Honor, I would say that the record, if the court believes that there is jurisdiction to address this issue, first I would say that that Mr. Brown did not timely, clearly, unequivocally waive his right to counsel, that his decision to waive counsel was not voluntary, was not knowingly and intelligently made, and then I think we get to the next argument as to whether or not did he, you know, did Mr. Brown...
Well, the court relied on our decision at McNair to reach the conclusion it did that this was essentially a constructive waiver of counsel. He went through four lawyers, couldn't get along with any of them. And I think you can, you know, in McNair, and I'm very familiar with McNair since I wrote the opinion in that case, but in McNair we reversed the trial court, but we noted that there are circumstances in which you can constructively waive counsel. It's not an endless, you know, you're not allowed to endlessly abuse the process by constantly, you know, demanding a different counsel. So at some point, the line has to be drawn. I guess the trial court relied on McNair, and the question is whether it properly did so or not. In this case, will we reach the merits of this?
So if the court is able to reach the merits of this, I would say in the June 16th, 2015 court hearing, the court hearing immediately preceding the trial date, as soon as the trial court said to Mr. Brown, if I'm going to release Ms. Commander and you are no longer, I found that I cannot not appoint counsel because it just wouldn't be effective, at that exact moment is when the error could have been corrected, where he said, Judge, I don't want to proceed without counsel. I am not waiving my right to counsel. I want to reinstate Ms. Phillips. Once the court said no, then he said, well, then I want to reinstate Ms. Commander. I mean, it was at that point where he was trying to kind of rectify his request that he said, well, I have a conflict of interest with Ms. Commander, or I don't want Ms. Phillips. As soon as the court notified him, which the court should have, pursuant to the Fraser L case, the U.S. Court of Appeals case, at that point, the judge said, okay, I'm not going to appoint counsel anymore.
Well, let me ask you this about that, because the trial court made some factual findings here. Let's see if we find it really quickly here. The court found that your client's, quote, difficulties with various attorneys amounted to a pattern of conduct. And that's in reference to his reliance upon McNair, the trial court's reliance upon McNair, where we said that the right to counsel is not a right subject to endless abuse by the defendant. And I think we also said in McNair, if I remember correctly, that that the right to counsel is not the right to endlessly delay the proceedings. At some point, you know, you have to strike a blow for, you know, for the process, so to speak, over the and so if the trial court made what it seems to me is a factual finding that that your client was using his right to appoint a counsel and the difficulties he had with so many of them as simply a delaying tactic, that does seem to be supported by the evidence. If that is in fact the case, why wouldn't McNair stand for the proposition that he's waived his right to counsel effectively?
If the record was replete with was filled with instances where he was asking for new counsel and also asking to continue the case. So on June 16th, when he asks be relieved of Ms. Commander and Ms. Phillips, he doesn't ask for a continuance.
Well, but he effectively is. I mean, when you're asking for brand new counsel, you're effectively asking for a continuance.
But then when he asks to have those counsel come back, are you saying that
they were prepared,
initiated his request for the continuance then?
I do. I mean, and even though, Judge Decker, you're saying that he did, because by asking for new counsel, a new counsel wouldn't be prepared, I think it was 7 days, right? It was exactly a week, and that is correct. I mean, obviously, if the court had appointed new counsel, the court would not have required counsel to proceed in a week. However, once Mr. Brown had said, no, I want Ms. Phillips, and the court said, no, I want Ms. Commander, there was no indication that Ms. Commander was not prepared to go forward. She had indicated she's been working on the case for a year.
And well, didn't the judge take a sort of middle ground by saying, well, I'll have her be standby? And doesn't that essentially put her in a position where she could have interceded and made some of the appropriate objections?
The judge ruled that as standby counsel, she was not to initiate any legal representation with Mr. Brown. So she stated, Ms. Commander, I'm not requiring you to initiate anything, but to just be there if he has questions. So he wouldn't have known, I need to preserve for appeal the fact that the court has found that I've de facto waived my right to counsel. And so that was not her
So your position is she couldn't have whispered into his ear.
Well, according to the...
If you care about this, you need to preserve it.
According to what the judge had instructed her, she was not to initiate legal representation. She was to be standby, to just stand there if Mr. Brown had any questions.
I think you raise a fair point, and I got to say that I think the law is pretty clear, at least right now, that you either have counsel or you don't, and standby counsel doesn't cut it. I understand courts do that in an effort to prevent further delays in the event that the defendant is being dilatory and elects to change his mind. You can just sort of wave counsel from the back row of the courtroom up to counsel's table. But standby counsel is not counsel, I think, is the current state of the law. And I guess I'm supporting your argument in that regard. But I think the point you're not really addressing very well is whether, you know, given the court's factual findings, which I think are, if not explicit, at least implicit here, that your client was seeking to delay his trial by manufacturing all these difficulties with his various counsel, at what point, I mean, what part of McNair would not have been satisfied here given all of that, given those factual findings?
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree with you about the fact that Mr. Brown was consistently trying to delay. With Mr. Hemingway, when he made a motion to withdraw based on the dissolution of the attorney-client privilege, it was Mr. Tanner who had been appointed below. And so, in fact, that was not a delay. This case had several different indictments that came at different times. So if this was I think it was 10 indictments that came all at one time, and then this was continuance after continuance after continuance, what the record, I think, is clear about is that there were charges that happened in general district court, that then there was a preliminary hearing, got up to circuit court. Then there were direct indictments, but they all kind of happened at different times. Once all of the charges, I think it wasn't until months later that that we had all 10 charges. With regard to the motions to continue, it really wasn't until the very last, while there were motions to continue, that wasn't because counsel needed time to catch up. Ms. Commander was the attorney for over a year. So it's not until June 16th where he says, I want a new attorney. The judge says, I'm not giving you a new attorney. Then he says, well, then I want Ms. Commander. He doesn't make the motion to continue until after he has already asserted his desire to have Ms. Commander. The judge said no. On June 23rd is when he makes the motion to continue. So if he was making a motion to, and I understand Judge Decker's argument that he was making the motion to by asking new counsel, he was essentially asking for a motion to continue, but that could have been rectified by the court just appointing Ms. Commander at his request, saying, I want her to be reinstated. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You've eaten into your rebuttal time, but we'll go ahead and we've asked you lots of questions, so we'll give you a minute when,
thank you, Judge,
after Mr. Obenshain has argued. Mr. Obenshain, you have 15 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Chris Obenshain representing the Commonwealth in this matter.
Mr. Obenshain, you didn't, at least on brief, you didn't raise a jurisdictional issue, but what do you have anything you want to say about that?
Your Honor, I would, just looking at the plea agreement itself, I would agree with the court's interpretation that the plea agreement specifically says that he is preserving the argument about the legality of the search of his residence, that he does not specifically, that he enters a conditional plea of guilty, and that the only argument that he specifically preserves on appeal is the legality of the search of his residence. So I would agree with the court in terms of its jurisdiction to address the right to counsel, that he did not specifically preserve that argument. With regard to the legality of the search of his residence, I'll address that first, since it was addressed first here. But again, I think it's clear that in this instance, there was no fruit of any illegal search, even assuming that the search of the residence was illegal, and the trial court didn't reach that issue. The trial court said basically, even if we assume it was, the exclusionary rule doesn't apply in this instance because essentially there was no fruit of that search. There was nothing recovered by the police officers during the protective sweep. And the statement in the search warrant affidavit that the residence was being secured by law enforcement, I think it's even debatable whether that refers to the protective sweep itself or just the fact that there were officers stationed at the residence waiting, which the officer who completed the affidavit knew. But there was no information relayed, and for those reasons, I mean, the Commonwealth would rest on its argument on brief for that point. As to the right to counsel, of course, court has already pointed out, the Sixth Amendment right to counsel is not unlimited. It's a right to a fair opportunity to be represented by counsel. And here, Mr. Brown was not, if this court reaches the merits of that argument, Mr. Brown was not denied the right to counsel. He was given a fair opportunity to have the assistance of counsel by four separate counsel being appointed to him.
Counsel, what's the effect in your mind of the defendant's, the appellant's request at the June 16th hearing to reinstate counsel who the court removed? Because the court said you're essentially just trying to continue this case, and so I'm not going to appoint new counsel for you at that point. The defendant says, no, I'd like to have these lawyers stay on then. Does that have any effect?
Well, what Mr. Brown had asked the court to do is to reinstate Ms. Phillips,
right?
Not Ms. Commander. He asked the court to reinstate Ms. Phillips, who had only been appointed a short while beforehand, and she represented to the court. And in fact, I think it's important to note, before Mr. Brown made that request, I mean, first of all, the reason why this argument occurred is because Mr. Brown filed a pro se motion to remove both of his attorneys, Ms. Commander and Ms. Phillips. And he accused Ms. Phillips of lying to him, and he accused Ms. Commander of having a conflict of interest. And so.
And then he backed off that, though.
But then when the court said, you know, I'm not going to appoint new counsel. Then he asked the court to appoint Ms. Phillips to represent him. And Ms. Phillips had already represented to the trial court that she had only been representing him for a short time. She had only prepared for one portion of the argument in the court, and that she wouldn't be prepared to represent him on the trial date.
And so you disagree that the record reflects that he then said he would take Ms. Commander?
I would disagree with that, Your Honor. I don't. And certainly counsel can point it out if I'm mistaken, but I don't believe he asked for Ms. Commander to be appointed. I believe he maintained his insistence that Ms. Phillips now be represented to appoint him. And in that respect, I think the trial court was absolutely justified in finding that request was essentially a request for a continuance. And the trial court said that, you know, again, that one more request for an attorney, or one more attorney, one more continuance is not going to be effective in making its ruling. And so the request to have Ms. Phillips represent him at trial after he had moved to dismiss her, after he had accused her of lying to him, that was a request for a delay of the trial. And I think, in addition, you know, the court has to look at it in the context of the entire case. The court has to look at all the circumstances of the case and the conduct of the defendant in its entirety. And if you look at the, I believe it's the May, the hearing May 23rd or something, May 27th, 2015 hearing, when the court was going through trying to appoint co-counsel, Mr. Brown insisted on having counsel appointed to him that it had already been determined would not be available until February of the next year. And this is in May of 2015. The Commonwealth says that attorney's not available until February of next year, and Mr. Brown says, I want him. And so I think that lends context to what the trial court was dealing with. The trial court said, I'm not going to delay the trial that far. You know, we're going to move forward on this. And then a couple of weeks later, from May 27th, June 8th, he files this motion to dismiss both of his attorneys. And then we come back on June 16th, I believe it was, and then he changes his mind again and asks for Ms. Phillips to be appointed to represent him. And so I think the trial court's factual finding that this was a pattern of conduct was supported by that evidence. And those are the examples of his efforts to delay the trial that the trial court relied upon in making that factual finding. And based on the fact that there was evidence in the record to support that finding, if the court reaches the merits of that argument, I think there's clearly no error on the part of the trial court in making that finding that this was an unreasonable request to delay the trial that was unwarranted. And that's why I think this case is more akin to Bailey than McNair, in that you have a defendant who has repeatedly made a series of motions, pro se motions, when he was represented by counsel. He has repeated efforts to obstruct and delay his attorneys. And I think the other fact that we have to examine is the fact that this was not a complicated case. Looking at the proffer of the Commonwealth's evidence when he finally does enter the guilty plea, all of these transactions were captured on video. There was no question that he was the person responsible for these drug offenses. And so these unreasonable demands that he continues to make on his attorneys in the context of the case make it all that more unreasonable.
Well, you're entitled to counsel no matter how simple the case is, right?
That's true, Your Honor. But I think in the trial court's determination of whether Mr. Brown was being unreasonable and making unreasonable demands of his counsel and obstructing his counsel and trying to delay, I think that's a relevant fact. And so taking all that evidence into consideration, should the trial court reach the merits of the argument, I think it's clear that Mr. Brown was given a fair opportunity to have the representation of counsel, that he made repeated efforts to delay the trial and that the trial court's finding that, that he engaged in a pattern of conduct that was designed to do just that was supported by the evidence. And we'd ask the trial court, or we'd ask this court to affirm the trial court.
Thank you, Mr. Obershane. Okay, Ms. Freed, you've got a minute.
I can do it quickly. So
use
I just want
to use it wisely.
On the appendix on page 157, Mr. Obershane said that Mr. Brown did not ask for Ms. Commander. He did. So Mr. Casey, the prosecutor, says, I'll be here at 9 a.m. on Tuesday, which is the trial date. Mr. Brown says, Your Honor, can I reinstate Ms. Commander? Yes, because I can't represent myself. I was not aware. And so she says, okay, I'm going to appoint Ms. Commander as a standby counsel. So at that point, he does ask for Ms. Commander, so there is not a delay. With regard to the argument that Mr. Brown had asked for Mr. Eustace for the purpose of delaying the trial, that is incorrect. Ms. Commander was the attorney who notified the court that Mr. Eustace was not available because he was involved in a federal murder case. It wasn't Mr. Brown. Mr. Brown did not know that after he learned that. He was given Ms. Phillips. He did not ask for Mr. Eustace with the purpose of delaying the trial. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. All right, we're going to come